Now, there's a box up here in the front of the room. If you have extra credit assignments, I know you haven't even thought about it, but some of you will be your readers. If you have either extra credit assignments or requests for recommendations, you can put them in this box. Now, what I want to do today is I want to discuss how you use all those methods we talked about last time in order to do something useful, which in this case is to get glucose from the lumen of the intestine into body cells. Because we all know we eat glucose, but then how does it get where it's supposed to go? Now, for this, what you need is handout 6A. And what we have a diagram of here is the anatomical setup. So let's just see what the basic setup is, and then we'll go over it. So up here would be the lumen of the intestine. That is, this is the space inside your intestines, and it's surrounded by a layer of epithelial cells, as we explained last time. So here we have a cross-section of those epithelial cells, and they're joined by tight junctions. That's what this represents. So remember, of course, this is only a cross-section. So what we mean is we have a layer of these cells. Of course, really, they go all the way around the lumen. So this is like a layer of orange juice containers, and they are sealed. Now, that means that glucose has to pass from the lumen, which is where it is after you ate it. It can't go between the cells. It has to go across these cells. But then, to get to its target, it's going to go into the blood supply, through the blood supply around the body, and then out of the blood supply into the tissue. So I've drawn the target tissue down here on the bottom. So this is any cell of the body, a liver cell, brain cell, doesn't matter. And we're going to talk specifically about muscle and adipose cells because they're a little bit different. But most of it is the same. Now, we said that there's a blood supply, so this is meant to be the blood supply. And in particular, these would be the capillaries, the very fine blood vessels nearest the epithelial cells. And then through the blood supply, we come to the capillaries near the target tissue. Now, as shown here in your handout, the cells that make up the layer surrounding the capillary are not tightly joined. So that means that if glucose makes it across, it will be able to then go across the space containing extracellular material into the blood vessel, and then it'll be able to go through the blood vessel, and then at various spots in the body, in particular near our target cells, the glucose can get out of the blood vessels, and then it has to get into the cell. Now, in the extracellular matrix surrounding these cells, there is, of course, liquid. And so the liquid that makes up not the blood, but the liquid surrounding the cells in the body is called the interstitial fluid, as written on the left of your handout. And this is sometimes abbreviated IF. Now, this is the same as intermediate filaments, so you have to know by context which one you're talking about. So we're saying that glucose has to go into the epithelial cell, out of the epithelial cell, through the interstitial fluid, into the capillary, through the blood, out of the capillary, across the interstitial fluid, into the target cell. And now we want to look at what processes are involved in doing that. Now, we've indicated this by the symbols on your handout, that the first thing is, how does glucose get into these epithelial cells? It does so by active transport, but by secondary active transport. You know, we've talked about glucose-sodium co-transport. That's what's happening here. The sodium is binding to the carrier, because this is to the carrier transport protein. That the sodium binds, that causes the binding of glucose. That causes the protein to flip, and both the glucose and the sodium find themselves inside. Now, remember, what's the concentration of sodium inside a cell relative to the outside? For a normal cell, there's much more potassium inside than outside, and much more sodium outside than inside. And the reason for this is the constant working of the sodium-potassium pump, driven by the energy of hydrolysis of ATP, and we've drawn this on the side here. The sodium-potassium pump is working in the background. That's the wrong one, but thank you. Thanks a lot, Jesse. So, since it's working in the background, ATP is being split inside the cell, and as a result, sodium is being pushed out and potassium is being pushed in. And that means that there's constantly, in all cells, a gradient of sodium higher outside than inside. So if we allow sodium to go down its gradient, it will flow into the cell. So sodium here is going down its gradient, and that's providing the energy to push the glucose up its gradient. So the glucose gets into the epithelial cell. Now, some of that glucose is going to be used for metabolism of the cell itself. The cell has to run, carry out glycolysis, oxidative metabolism, etc. But a little bit of that glucose then is used by the cell for metabolism. But most of it is going to be passed on to the bloodstream to be used by other cells. So what have we got here? We've got primary active transport. That's keeping the sodium gradient up. Then we have secondary active transport, helping taking advantage of that gradient to get the glucose in. Now, how are we going to get glucose out of this cell? Can it just diffuse across a membrane? Glucose is too big and polar to diffuse across a membrane. So anytime glucose enters or exits the cell, it must have some kind of transport protein to help it. So there is a transport protein here and a transport protein here. But remember, these are polarized cells. They have different sets of proteins on the two surfaces. And this is one example, because the protein that is used to get glucose out of the cell is a different one. Now, if we've been pumping glucose into this cell, there's a lot of glucose there. And that glucose is constantly going out all the way down to its target. And in fact, the way this is set up, glucose is being pulled into this cell. Everything from here on is passive. Glucose is going down its gradient. You can think of the glucose being pulled at the far end, which keeps the concentration here, lower than here, lower than here, lower than here, lower than there. So glucose is always going down its gradient. So that means that the protein here is promoting its carrier-mediated transport. This is passive transport down its gradient, while to get into the cell, it was active transport up the gradient. So you have two different proteins here. One at the top that carries out glucose-sodium co-transport, and one at the bottom that simply allows glucose to go down its gradient. This is the old revolving door model. And this is going to be one of those GLUT proteins, for glucose transporter, that we talked about last time. This particular one happens to be GLUT2. Now, the protein that allows glucose and sodium to come in together, the co-transporter, is also a member of a protein family. just as all the glucose transporters, GLUT1, GLUT2, GLUT3, are a protein and gene family. So all these co-transport proteins are also a family, and they are called SGLT for sodium, not N for NA, but S, sodium glucose transport. So those are SGLT proteins as opposed to GLUT proteins. These proteins carry out different functions, and they are different. Now, once the glucose gets out then of the epithelial cell and goes down its gradient into the interstitial fluid, this is just liquid, no membranes, so the glucose can diffuse. Now, how does it get into capillaries? I drew here an arrow in between cells. These cells are not tightly joined. So when the glucose enters a capillary, it is not going across a membrane. It is going along spaces between cells. Now, this is sort of hard to understand unless you know something about the structure of capillaries. We're not interested here in anatomy for its own sake, but sometimes we have to draw a structure so you know what we're talking about. So if you look at handout C on the bottom, we have some pictures here from a textbook showing the structure of a capillary. On the left, the structure is shown longitudinally from the outside, and on the right, there's a cross-section. Now, I'm going to post these for you on coursework. Since they come from a textbook, I'm not going to put them accessible to the world. But there are in your notes also links to images from Google of both of these. Now, the picture on the left shows you that just as you have a layer of epithelial cells surrounding a lumen or a space of the intestine, you have a layer of epithelial cells surrounding the space in a capillary, the capillary being the very fine blood vessels. So these cells are all connected to each other, but there are little spaces in the middle between them, and these are the pores. And material which is small enough can diffuse in and out through those pores. Now, to show this another way, if you look at the cross section, it looks sort of like this. So this is one of those epithelial cells. This is another, and these are the pores through which material can enter or exit a capillary. And those pores are big enough in most cells for small molecules, but not for proteins. So proteins, if they enter or exit, are going to have to go across the cells. Now, these are epithelial cells, cells that form sheets and linings, but the ones that line the blood vessels have a special name. They're called endothelial cells. Now, epithelia, as we discussed before, usually have tight junctions. These cells in the capillary, endothelial cells, generally do not have tight junctions. So they're joined, but not by tight junctions. And this is very important because this makes the capillaries porous. Because there are these pores, small molecules can get in and out. But small molecules cannot get across the space between the epithelial cells lining the lumen. Now, there is an exception to this no tight junction business. In the brain, the capillaries are joined by tight junctions. So in the body, there are no tight junctions. But in the brain, they are. And this makes up what is known as the blood-brain barrier. Meaning that material that's carried in the blood cannot get into the brain cells and vice versa. Now, this can be good news or this can be bad news. If someone is taking a drug and you don't want it to affect the brain, it won't. But if you're giving somebody a drug and you want it to affect the brain, it won't get in from the blood. So, to come back to our cells then, in most of the body then, the endothelial cells wrapped around the capillaries do not have tight junctions, and so material can diffuse just through the liquid, not crossing any membranes, into the capillary. It's carried by the bloodstream, and it can diffuse out of the capillary and across the interstitial fluid to the membrane of the target cells. Now, how is glucose going to get into the target cell? How is it going to cross this membrane? Do we need a protein? We always need a protein. Glucose cannot get across a membrane without a transport protein. So we're definitely going to need a protein. And glucose is going to be going down its gradient. So if it's going down its gradient, what kind of protein do we need? We can use one of these gluten proteins, carrier-mediated transport, passive. We don't need a co-transporter. So in fact, there is a glute protein here. And which one there is depends on the cell type. Red blood cells, we said, have glute 1. Liver cells have that and glute 2, etc. But the reason we wrote liver and adipose, muscle and adipose on your handout is that muscle and fat cells have a very special property in that they have GLUT4. And we mentioned last time that the thing that's special about GLUT4 is that it can be mobilized and stuck into the membrane, or it can be decommissioned and taken out of the membrane. It can sit around in vesicles away from the membrane. Or those vesicles can fuse and put GLUT4 in. And as we explained, GLUT4 is mobilized or stuck into the membrane where it can be used in response to insulin. Now, as we mentioned last time, I think in response to a question, insulin and GLUT4 do not stick to each other. Insulin sticks to a receptor, and that receptor's binding triggers the mobilization of GLUT4. Now, the reason this is important is that if there is no insulin or no response to insulin, then these cells cannot take up glucose because they have GLUT4 inside, but it's in the wrong place, and they can't do anything. Now, in liver cells and in red blood cells, the appropriate GLUT protein is always in the membrane. So those cells can always take up glucose if it's available. But that's not true for muscle. In a person with diabetes, there's plenty of glucose outside, but the muscle cells cannot take it up. Now, I said that everything is passive or downhill from the top. But we're stuffing glucose into this cell at the bottom. How do we keep the glucose concentration inside low? So if you look at your handout, you notice there's one more step. That the glucose inside is phosphorylated almost immediately by the appropriate enzyme. And so that enzyme, which is a kinase, adds phosphate to the glucose. And glucose phosphate cannot use this transporter. There are no transporters for glucose phosphate. And glucose phosphate is trapped inside the cell. However, if you've converted your glucose to glucose phosphate, what's the concentration of glucose inside this cell? Low or high? It's low from the chemical point of view. Now, you're not fooled. You know there's glucose there in the form of glucose phosphate. But in the point of view of a gradient of concentration of glucose outside versus concentration of glucose inside, there's a big gradient because there's little free glucose inside, a lot of free glucose outside, and so glucose uses this carrier protein to flow into the cell where the glucose is phosphorylated and then it's trapped. Now, I think I mentioned last time that liver is probably one of the only cells in the body that can not only take up glucose, but release glucose. To release glucose, what do you have to do first? You have to knock that phosphate off. And liver is the only tissue, probably, that has an enzyme, a phosphatase, that can take the phosphate off so the glucose can actually go through the same transporter back out into the blood. Liver acts as sort of a buffer. It picks up glucose when there is extra and releases it when it's needed, and how that works we'll talk about more another time. All right, so let's sort of see here. We've gone over all the structures. We've gone over where the glucose goes. And now let's sort of think about it from the point of view of all the processes we talked about last time. Do we have primary active transport here? Do we need it? Well, we need it to maintain the sodium gradient. Do we have secondary active transport here? Yeah, glucose, sodium, co-transport. Do we have carrier-mediated, facilitated diffusion? Yes, we do. We have it out of the epithelial cells and into the target cells. Do we have diffusion? Well, we don't have diffusion across a membrane, but we have diffusion within liquid, both through the interstitial fluid and in and out of the capillary. Now, there's only one kind of transport that is not on this picture. Do you see any channels anywhere? The truth is, there are channels in this picture. I just didn't draw them. So I want you to take a minute, think about everything you heard today and yesterday, discuss it maybe with the person next to you. Where are the glucose channels? And the hint is they're not usually called channels. Suggest where there might be channels for glucose? What'd you say?
Pores.
Well, you could call pores channels, but they're not specifically what people think of. The pores are just spaces. What about in the back there?
Gap junctions connecting the epithelial cells.
Aha! Gap junctions. Remember I said that these channels are not usually called channels. Where are the gap junctions here? As he says, there are gap junctions here. There are connexons, the double bagel model, in between these epithelial cells. Now, these are not specific channels for glucose, but they are large enough to allow glucose to diffuse. So that means that glucose can be passed from one cell in the sheet to any other cell in the sheet. So glucose does go through channels here in the gap junctions, which are sometimes considered in a slightly different category because they're larger than the usual channel. Now, I think this covers what I wanted to say about how you move your glucose around. So before I move on to talking about how you move big molecules around, let me ask if there are questions before I go on. How does glucose become dephosphorylated in the epithelial cells? Well, generally it doesn't, because if you think about the reactions that you know of glycolysis, which then lead to oxidative metabolism, they all start with phosphorylated glucose or phosphorylated fructose. So you don't need to take the phosphates off. In fact, it's better to have a phosphate on. And the production of glycogen, which is the storage form of glucose, also requires phosphorylated glucose. But you look puzzled.
Well, you said that the liver cells are the only cells that have the dehydrogenation enzyme. So then, don't the skin cells also need to use some of the glucose? So they wouldn't they phosphorylate everything?
Her question is, why don't the cells here phosphorylate everything, in which case it would never get out? So what we're saying is these cells, unlike most target cells, don't phosphorylate all of the glucose. They only phosphorylate enough for their energy needs. And the rest of it remains unphosphorylated, or it wouldn't be able to get out. Yeah?
Does that lack of phosphorylation have to do with the enzyme Vmax?
Does the lack of phosphorylation have to do with the enzymes Vmax? I very much doubt it. I suspect that the glucose is sequestered in some special part of the cell, but I don't really know. Any other questions before we go on? Well, everything we've talked about here and last time was all about moving small molecules across membranes. And now I want to consider, how do you get big molecules across membranes? And there are three basic ways that big molecules get into cells, and we're going to focus on one of them, but first I just want to mention what the three are and what the difference is, and then we'll go into the details of the case that we're interested primarily in. Now, all of these methods involve the invagination of the forming of a vesicle. So one way it happens, so if you start with the plasma membrane, it can bend in, and then that piece can pinch off and form a vesicle, so that now we have this. And any material that was out here is now going to be trapped inside. And this vesicle can carry that material to some appropriate part of the cell. Now, all eukaryotic cells are thought to do this on a small scale all the time, and to grab little bits of the liquid outside the cell and whatever happens to be inside. People sometimes call this cell drinking. The cell takes little sips of what's outside, and this is usually called pinocytosis. Now, on the other hand, although all cells do this, only some specialized cells grab large hunks of stuff from the outside. And this is the process called phagocytosis. Originally, people sort of thought of this one I drew is like cell drinking. Phagocytosis is like cell eating. And it's done by phagocytic cells, that is, amoeboid-like cells. And what the cells do now this time is that the cell extends pseudopods. So instead of bending out in, the membrane sort of bends out. And then these come together. And now they've encircled a bit of what was out here. And now these membranes fuse, and again, you have a vesicle. Now, in order to extend these pseudopods, you have to have microfilaments. And only certain specialized amoeboid-type cells do phagocytosis. Everybody does pinocytosis. Now, what we want to talk about today is a variation, I guess, on pinocytosis, which is usually called RME, or receptor mediated endocytosis. Now, pinocytosis is a type of endocytosis, just mean bending in of the membrane and forming a vesicle. But the difference is receptor-mediated means that there is a specific receptor on the surface of the cell. So this time, there is a specific trapping of the ligand for this receptor, and then the formation of a vesicle, and that vesicle will have in it not just a random sample of whatever junk is out there, but it will be enriched for samples of the ligand that's stuck to the receptor. We know a lot about receptor-mediated endocytosis. We think most cells do it, but they have different receptors and trap different ligands. And it's a very important process, and it seems to be one of the primary ways in which proteins and other big things get into cells. And today I want to talk about the basic scheme. So for that you need your handout B. Your B handout shows the basic picture, the basic cycle. Now, we've already said that for any substance to be carried into the cell by receptor-mediated endocytosis, you're going to have a receptor for that material. So I've drawn here at least two different kinds of receptors. A real cell would have many different kinds of receptors, each one specific for a different ligand. And since it traps a particular ligand and brings it into the cell, this process actually concentrates material. It actually pulls it up its gradient. And so this process requires energy. We're not going to discuss the exact steps that require it, but it does. Now, in order for this to work, I'm going to have to put down the mic for a minute. This is the cell membrane. You're going to have to invaginate the cell membrane. Now, I bought this to try and demonstrate it, and I realized as soon as I bought these balloons that you can't indent them. But this actually illustrates an important principle, that a real membrane doesn't indent either, unless it has a protein, a peripheral protein on the inside, which promotes the curvature of the membrane. So there's a protein underneath the membrane, and that's drawn on your handout. Now, any membrane that forms vesicles has some sort of peripheral protein to help with the deformation of the membrane. But for the plasma membrane, the protein which I've drawn here, this is a peripheral protein on the inside. The one involved in deforming the plasma membrane is called clathrin. And clathrin is found in patches underneath the membrane. Now, the first thing that happens, as shown on your handout, is binding of the ligand. So let's say the ligand this time is this one. So let's see, if it's the circular ligand, it's going to bind to these receptors and not to this one. So in my next step, I've drawn the binding. Now, I didn't draw any change here in the conformation of the receptor. But as I drew earlier when I was talking about receptors, usually when a receptor binds its ligand, there is a conformational change in the receptor in the intracellular domain. And that is how the cell, quote unquote, knows or detects that something has happened, and this triggers events inside the cell that give you some action, like GLUT4 mobilization in response to insulin. Now, in this picture, I have not drawn any conformational change, but it would definitely happen. Now, I've only drawn one ligand here binding at a time, but in fact, in most cells, multiple ligands would be binding to the appropriate receptors. Now, the next step, how are we going to get the stuff inside? The membrane is going to have to bend, and we know that it's going to bend in the place where that peripheral protein is. So what happens is there's lateral diffusion in the membrane. We have to move the receptors into the area where the clathrin is. And that's what's shown in the next stage. You have lateral diffusion into the region where the clathrin is and where the membrane starts to deform and to bend. Now, some receptors seem to move into the clathrin area, whether they're full or whether they're empty. They just, at a random way, move. But some only move if they're full. So that's why I've drawn an empty one here, as well as two full ones, the assumption being that this type of receptor, with the triangular grabber, is able to move to an area like this, which is called a coated pit. The membrane is coated on the inside with clathrin, and it starts to deform, therefore the pit. And now what happens is that we have an invagination. Now, you notice as this happens that what used to be on the outside of the cell is now on the inside of the vesicle. And that isn't so obvious, but if we go back to our balloon, if I could really push in further, you realize that what I would be pushing in the indentation, what's inside the indentation, actually used to be on the surface. So if this is the exterior or E side of the membrane, when I make a vesicle or an indentation or a pit, the old E is now inside the vesicle. Need the mic. Okay. So in order to do this now, we're actually going to have to pinch off. It wasn't enough to just invaginate. We now have to pinch off this membrane and rejoin the vesicle and the plasma membrane. And that's what's shown in the next step at the end of 4. Now, all of these processes require additional proteins, and many of them require energy. But we are not being specific about the details. You can read about it in Becker, or you can take cell biology and hear it all. So at this point, the plasma membrane now is separate from our vesicle. And I'm not going to draw the whole thing, but you got it. Now this is called a coated vesicle, for reasons that you can understand. It's a vesicle, and it still has its coat of clathrin on it. Now, this whole thing is a cycle. As people realized yesterday, if this happened and only went this far, we would, in fact, the plasma membrane would get smaller and smaller. But in fact, it's a cycle. And some of this membrane material is actually going to be returned back up to the plasma membrane. And this clathrin is going to be used over again. Remember that peripheral proteins associate with the membrane by weak bonds. And so at this point, the clathrin can come off. And the clathrin can go back up to the plasma membrane to form another coated pit and do it all over again. So in step 5, which I'm going to draw here because otherwise I can see I'm not going to have enough room. The clathrin comes off so it can be recycled, and we're left with this uncoated vesicle. Now, up to this point, it's usually called the vesicle, uncoated vesicle, coated vesicle, whatever. But inside the cell now, we're going to get some action because some of the, depending on exactly what material went into the cell, what is going to happen next? Well, some of it is going to go back where it came from. In fact, some of this membrane has to go back up to the surface or the cell will get smaller. And what's going to happen to this protein, these proteins, and to these ligands is going to depend on which receptor ligand pair we've got. In some cases, everything that we trapped is going to get degraded. It's all going to go to lysosomes and it's all going to be broken down. In some cases, almost nothing will be broken down. It's all going to go back where it came from. And in the third sort of compromise case, some of this stuff is going to get degraded, and some of it is going to go back to the membrane. So in order for this to operate, if you've got to sort things out. Some stuff has to go back to the membrane, some stuff has to stay in the cell and go usually to lysosomes to be degraded. So the next stage, you have what is usually called a sorting vesicle or an endosome. Now, in this structure, the pieces get sorted out. So I've drawn it like this to emphasize that it has at least two regions. One region contains stuff that is going to go back up to the plasma membrane, and one region contains stuff that's going to remain inside the cell. What causes things to separate inside an endosome is that an endosome is slightly acid. So protons are pumped into this vesicle, into this structure, the endosome, using active transport. So there's an ATP using proton pump in the membrane, and it puts protons in. So things become a little acid, and that causes many weak associations to fall apart. Now, we could consider many possibilities, but for this particular one, let's consider what happens with what is called LDL, or low-density lipoprotein. This is a complex of protein and lipid, and I'll talk a little bit more about exactly what it looks like later. The point here is that it's one of the things that's trapped by a receptor. Now, in this particular case, I want to draw it to match your handout. The receptor and its respective ligand separate. So the receptors end up in one part of the endosome, and the ligand ends up in a different one because of the slightly acid conditions. This separation then means that a vesicle can bind butt off this part of the endosome, and it will contain only receptors and leave the ligand behind. A vesicle can butt off this part and carry only ligand, no receptors. And that's exactly what happens next. And so in your next picture, as the end result of 7, we now have two separate vesicles. I haven't got my sizes right here, so you shouldn't be surprised. One kind of vesicle has only receptors, and one has only ligands such as LDL. Now, what is going to happen here? I've got 8A and 8B. So these are all inside the cell, and there's clathrin on the surface of the cell. What is going to happen to these two particular vesicles? Well, this vesicle is going to fuse with lysosomes. Remember, lysosomes are vesicles or organelles that are very acid and contain acid hydrolases. That is, they contain enzymes that degrade macromolecules, and they all have an acid pH optimum. So it's a little acid in an endosome and very acid in a lysosome. So if the lysosome fuses with this vesicle, These molecules are going to find themselves faced with enzymes that can degrade them, and they're going to get broken down. And in the case of LDL, that's going to release lipid and cholesterol, which is going to be used by the cell to build membranes. But now, what about the receptor? So let me label this properly according to your handout. 8A means these vesicles are going to go back and fuse with the plasma membrane, and as a result, they're going to deliver their receptors back to the membrane. So, 8A shows it right up against the membrane, and 8-9 shows you a fusion. Now, I realize at this point that I need to draw a little more carefully how membranes fuse. In order for this process to work, membranes have to invaginate. And we sort of understand how that happens. You sort of punch in the membrane and twist off a bubble. But then, further on, vesicles have to fuse with pre-existing vesicles. Or a vesicle has to fuse with a membrane. Now, in this example, this vesicle fuses with a lysosome. Sometimes it's some other part of the endomembrane system. But there is and here the other vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane. Now, how does that work? We usually draw something like this. Here is the vesicle, here's the plasma membrane. They come up right next to each other. They open up, and then it all rejoins. Now, if we were talking about DNA molecules and crossing over, what would we do? We would join these two ends and those two. We would rejoin it crosswise. But that's not how it works with membranes. With membranes, the way it works is you join these two and those two. So in the next step, it's going to look like this. Now you might ask, why does it do that? It's worth thinking about the difference in topology. When you're talking about DNA, you're talking about two strips, really. You're talking about let's say a two-dimensional strip and another two-dimensional strip, and you're cutting and splicing them. But here, what you're talking about is a whole sheet of three-dimensional membrane. So this is part of a whole sheet. This is part of a whole bubble. And you can't do the cross thing. It won't work. Now, I can't really demonstrate it with my bubble, but what we're really saying is you would have a mini balloon inside the big balloon. And you got to join the surface of the mini balloon to the big balloon. And in order to do that, you have to join it this way. Now, it might be a little clearer if we put into this what we're really doing. I drew one line there. What does it represent? It's actually a bilayer. So what we're really looking at is this has two layers and this has two layers. Now there's a P and an E side, so let's draw it in. So this one, this is the outside, so this is the E and this is the P. But what about this one? What faces the cytoplasm? This is the P here. So this is really the way they look. Now, I've color-coded it, so the side of the bilayer that faces the cytoplasm is the same color. So now, what happens when I put them together? So I'm going to skip up to this stage. What would it look like? It would look like this. So what I've done is to cut them both open. Now, who are we going to join to whom? Now, what we're saying is you have to join these like this, and you have to join that. And so, as in fact we expect, when I flatten it out, what was E here is going to be E entirely. And what was cytoplasmic side is going to be entirely facing the cytoplasm. Now, I think one of the easiest ways to keep track of this is, you know the famous saying, what goes in Vegas stays in Vegas. What starts in the cytoplasm stays in the cytoplasm. So if you focus on the cytoplasmic side, this side has to stay in the cytoplasm, and this side has to stay in the cytoplasm. So when I straighten it all out, it has to look like that. So now to go back to what's fusing with what, we've sort of got our whole cycle here once. But now I want to consider, we mentioned what could happen to the stuff here in the endosome. That some of this stuff can end up back on the plasma membrane. Some of this stuff can end up in a lysosome where it will get degraded. Some of it may fuse with other parts of the endomembrane system. But there is one other possibility which is worth mentioning. And that's perhaps easy to see if you go back to this picture of the cross-section of a capillary on C. Large materials going to get across this cell. If you have a protein, how is it going to get across from one side inside the capillary to the outside or vice versa? It is too big to go through the pores. So what basically happens is endocytosis on one side of the membrane followed by exocytosis on the other. So what's happening is you're forming a vesicle on one side, and then that vesicle is fusing with the plasma membrane on the other side. So you notice that on your picture, what you see is something here, and then it goes like this, and it goes like this, and then it goes like that. So that protein, and this, we didn't call it endo, we call this whole process endocytosis if the stuff only gets into the cell. But when a vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane and releases material, that's usually called exocytosis. Now, we've been focusing here on how you get things in. We'll focus next time on how you get things out. But you notice here that you sort of take it in on one side and spit it out on the other. And so this is sometimes called transcytosis, which is written on your handout. It's a way of carrying things all the way across by coupling the two. Now, you notice how this is similar to what was going on in our receptor-mediated picture. We took in a vesicle. The vesicle moved through the cytoplasm. Now, in our previous grand cycle, this vesicle would fuse back with the same surface it came from. But here, instead, it fuses with the other side of the cell, but it's a similar idea. Now, we didn't do this exactly in the order it's in the nuts, but we've now covered most of it up to the part about specific examples. And now I want to look at three different kinds of ligands. LDL is one of them, and see what kind of treatment they get. Because we've pointed out that what happens once you get to the endosome varies from case to case. And the three cases that I want to talk about involve three different ligands or substances that are taken into the cell by receptor-mediated endocytosis. They are LDL, low-density lipoprotein, EGF, which is a kind of growth factor, and transferrin. which is a protein for carrying around iron. Now, the point of all this is that LDL delivers lipid that the cell needs as a nutrient. EGF delivers a signal. It's a kick that says grow. And transferrin delivers iron, also a nutrient. So how does it work? Well, the first thing that you know is how many different receptors is it going to take in these three substances. Does each of these substances have its own specific receptor? To which the answer, of course, is yes. So one protein receptor binds to one binds to another, one binds to a third. So you have three different receptors on the surface of the cell. So I guess we'll start with the LDL receptor. So here's our cell surface, and here's the receptor, and we'll draw LDL looking like this. Now, the reason I did that is, what is LDL? It's low-density lipoprotein. Now, low-density means it's got an awful lot of lipid and not very much protein. Lipoprotein means it contains both lipid and protein. Now, what it is basically is cholesterol esters. And they're being delivered to the cells so they can build their own membranes. So it's a ball of esterified cholesterol. But this is itself too nonpolar to move through the blood. So it's coated not by a bilayer, but by a monolayer of polar lipids. So these are your standard amphipathic lipids plus some cholesterol. These are the kind of lipids that have a polar head and a nonpolar tail, and they form a ball around it with the polar end sticking out. And that will allow this material to float through the blood, because on the outside it's polar, although it's greasy as hell on the inside. Now, in order for this to stick to a receptor, it has to have a handle. And that handle is the protein part. There is one molecule of protein here, and only one. And this protein is called ApoB. This is what actually sticks to the receptor, and that's why I do the receptor and the LDL the way I did. So this would be the ApoB. This would be the rest of it. Actually, LDL is the whole thing, but this would be the lipid part, and here's the receptor. Now, what happens once this gets inside a cell? So the two stick together. They go to a coated pit. The coated pit invaginates. The vesicle pinches off. It loses its cathran and ends up in and fuses with an endosome. Now, I've talked here about fusion of vesicles with endosomes. People are not really sure whether the endosome sort of stays there and things come in and fuse and things move out, or whether what comes in changes its properties and turns into an endosome. The net result is the same. So if we go and look at what it's like in our endosome now, we said in the weak acidic environment of the endosome, the LDL with its ApoB separates from the receptor. So the LDL ends up in one part, and the receptor ends up in another. And we've already said that the receptor is going to recycle back to the plasma membrane. And LDL is going to end up in a lysosome. Now, the lysosome is needed because these esterified esters have to be de-esterified. You have to knock off the other half of the ester and release free cholesterol. And then the free cholesterol can be used by the cell to make its own membranes. Cells can make cholesterol. But they will take it up from the blood, which has cholesterol both made by the liver and from what you ate. Now, one of the reasons we know so much about this LDL business is because of a disease in which it messes up. And there is a disease called hypercholesterolemia, which just means high cholesterol in the blood. And we mentioned it last semester because it's one of the best known dominant diseases, meaning that if you have one good copy of the gene and one bad one, you are in trouble. Now, in this case, the gene that is responsible for this condition codes for the receptor for LDL. So people who are heterozygotes have half the normal number of receptors. Therefore, they take up half the amount of cholesterol, approximately, from the blood. Apparently, in this case, the amount of receptor is limiting. So if you have less receptor, you take up less cholesterol. Now, that's not so bad for the target cells. If they don't have enough cholesterol, they'll make more. But that means that a lot of cholesterol is left floating around in your blood. And that causes plaques, and that causes arteriosclerosis and heart attacks. So people who are heterozygous for this condition are at very high risk of heart attacks at a young age. Fortunately, this condition can be diagnosed, and it can be treated by a combination of diet and drugs to cut down on the amount of cholesterol in the blood. Now, this disease itself is fairly common. That is, there are a lot of heterozygotes around, but there aren't very many homozygotes, because a heterozygote has to marry a heterozygote, and then only one quarter of their kids get it. The number of homozygotes is quite small, which is good, because a homozygote has no receptor at all. And you can't do much of anything for them. They tend to get heart attacks when they're 10 years old. For them, the best thing you can do is prevention. So, genetic prevention. So, here we have the setup then. This is the LDL at the endosome stage, and we know what's going to happen. Vesicles, this is the end that's going to butt off vesicles saying, take me to a lysosome. And this is the end that's going to butt off vesicles saying, take me back up to the plasma membrane. And of course, it is the proteins that stick out, and the surface proteins, which are going to determine where the vesicle goes. Now, what about our other two cases? Well, EGF also has a receptor. Now, I'll draw it like this. EGF is epidermal growth factor. And the important part is the GF, which stands for growth factor. There are many different growth factors. They're made by one cell type, and they work on the same or another cell type. And they are usually triggers for growth, sometimes for differentiation, but usually for growth. And these then are signal molecules. They carry the word, do it. Now, when EGF binds to its receptor, the same thing happens in the beginning. The receptor and ligand go to a coated pit. The pit invaginates. You get a coated vesicle. You lose the coat. And then the EGF and receptor end up in an endosome. But in this case, they don't separate from each other. Both of them end up in this part of the endosome, the part that's going to go to a lysosome. Now, what's the rationale here? Once you've received the message, you don't need any more signal. This signal has done its thing. We understand why you might degrade it. But why are you degrading the receptor too? The argument is that once a cell has received a signal to grow, it doesn't need to respond to those signals anymore for some time. And in fact, being unresponsive to those signals is probably a good thing, because the cell doesn't want to get too much signal and grow when it shouldn't. So in addition to destroying the signal, the cell destroys the receptors. So the number of receptors on the cell surface is reduced. The receptors then are brought in from the surface and they don't make it back up again. And the result is what people call downregulation of receptors. Just meaning there's less of them. Because we have degraded some of the pre-existing ones. Now, you notice our two cases. In one, the receptor and its ligand separated. And in one, they stayed together. Now, the one remaining case I want to talk about is transferrin, which is a little bit different, but similar. So transferrin is a protein that goes through the blood and it carries iron. And it also has a receptor, which is, of course, different from the others, and specific for its shape and chemical composition. So transferrin comes along in the blood, binds to its receptor, and is taken into the cell through a coated pit, through a coated vesicle formation, then it's uncoated, and now in this endosome, what is going to happen? Well, the whole point of this is to deliver the iron to the growing cell, or the cell that needs it, because it's making proteins that require iron. In the endosome, the slight acidity makes the iron fall out, and then the iron, using a transport protein or a channel, exits the endosome and is used by the cell as a cofactor for proteins, enzymes, etc. Now, that means that inside the endosome, we still have the receptor, and we have what is called apotransferrin. Transferrin, that is. Now, apo means without cofactor. So, apotransferrin has no iron. ApoB by itself has no lipid. The combination is LDL. So, apo anything is without its partner. So, what about that apotransferrin? We could actually use it over again, send it back to the liver, and get some more iron. So in this case, neither the receptor nor the transferrin is degraded. So where are they going to be? They're going to be in the other part, the left, right part on our picture. So the receptor and the transferrin are both in the take me to the surface part of the endosome. They stick together. And now what's going to happen? We're going to send the LDL receptor, the transferrin receptor, and the transferrin all back up to the surface. In the meantime, the iron has been transported to where it can be used, and the LDL, EGF, and EGF receptor are going to get degraded, and their pieces are going to be reused. But all right, so what are we going to send back to the surface? Okay, more LDL receptor. Let's draw it over here. We're going to send back LDL receptor. Okay, we understand that. And we're going to send back transferrin and its receptor, except it's apotransferrin. Once it gets out the cell, outside the cell, what has to happen to do any good? We have to release the apotransferrin so we can go through the bloodstream, go back to the liver, pick up iron, and do it again. So it separates. Now, there is an apparent paradox here. Inside, at the traditional acid pH, these two do not separate. Most things separate at slightly acid pH, but transferrin and its receptor do not. Transferrin and its receptor stick on the outside, but they fall apart on the outside. Outside is neutral pH. At neutral pH, transferrin binds its receptor so it can go into the cell. But at neutral pH, transferrin leaves its receptor so it can get more iron. How is this possible? Are these two transferrins really the same? Notice only that one has iron. This is iron transferrin. This is apotransferrin. Apotransferrin and its receptor separate at neutral pH. But iron transferrin and its receptor stick together at neutral pH. And that's why this works. So we have here three cases, all use the same basic mechanism, but when you get to an endosome, they're sorted differently as to whether all of it's degraded, the ligand's degraded, or in fact, none of it really, none of the protein involved is degraded. If you think of it from the protein point of view, in the case of LDL, the receptor is not degraded, but the ApoB is. If you think about it, EGF, EGF and its receptor are both proteins, and they both get the X. In the case of transferrin, its receptor and the apotransferrin, the two proteins, both get recycled. So these three are not here so much because you know the need to know the details of these cases, but to illustrate the possibilities. Now I want to talk just for a minute more about how you follow this. How do we know where LDL goes? How do we know where EGF goes? How do we figure that out? So let me ask if there's a burning question or two before I go on. All right.
So you said that the apotransferrin, so there's apotransferrin attached to the receptor in the endosome that has an acidic pH. You said that should attach apotransferrin,
but
isn't it apotransferrin when it's attached?
But this is the question is, why does apotransferrin stick to its receptor here, but it comes apart when it gets outside? And the answer is, this is an acid pH, and that's a neutral pH. This is the reverse of the usual thing. They stick together at acid, but fall apart at neutral. Yeah?
Is that sticking together due to covalent bonds?
All that's sticking together here is due to weak bonds.
Would transcytosis take a receptor from one side of the tight junction band to the other side?
Could transcytosis carry a protein from one side of the tight junction band to the other? Yes, it could. Yeah.
Does the membrane, for endocytosis, does the membrane reorganize itself so that only relevant receptors are going to be in the vesicle?
In the endosome?
In
all of these cases, when you have membranes, they do have to reorganize themselves in some way and resort so that proteins accumulate in certain spots and not others, and that is due to other proteins which we're not drawing here.
So are there like random receptors that are also in the endosome that are just irrelevant?
Are there other receptors in the endosome? Yes. We have drawn only three receptors in the endosome. In a real cell, there would be many different receptors at once, all of them operating. Yeah?
What's going on with the hemochromatosis? Is that anything to do with this mechanism?
Hemochromatosis is due to accumulation of iron. Am I correct? But I don't remember why. I'd have to look it up. Yeah?
Is there a different type of lipid that helps coagulate the receptors before they get endocyte?
Is there anything special about the lipid here as opposed to the protein? In some cases, yes, but we're focusing here on the protein, which in the case of coated vesicles seems to be the clathrin. Now, I want to set up the situation, and then maybe we'll do it next time, but if you look now back at handout 6C, very briefly, you will notice that you see a picture on the left there with the little circles and the dots. Suppose you are examining, say, LDL, and you have some way, say, with using antibodies for ApoB or something, of finding it. And you see that some cells, these are meant to be cells, that in some cases you see this. In some cases, you see this, and in some cases, you see this. Is the substance you are following going in or out? Well, actually, the pictures look identical, unless you have some kind of time lapse. It could be, this is the first picture. Things start here, they go to here, and then they go to there. So now they've cleared out of here, and they're only there. And here they've cleaned out of there, and they're outside. But on the other hand, maybe they start here, some of them move into there, and then they move over, and new ones come in. You can't tell. You have to do some sort of labeling technique where you tell the difference. This, if you're following stuff in, you want to add some kind of labeled material, which is either radioactive or which contains fluorescence, so you can see it move across the cell. If you're following things out, you want to somehow tag the newly made stuff so you can see where it goes. So what we will do next time, and you want to bring back the C handout, is we will discuss both how you label things to follow things in and how you label things to follow things out.